Welcome to Subtitles, where we spike the canon in music and movies. In each episode, we will offer up replacements for each title in the top 100 of a well-known, well-regarded ranking, and we'll walk away with a pair of subtitles which we think deserve more acclaim and to which attention must be paid. I'm Tim. I'm replacing the entries on the 2007 AFI 100 Years 100 Movies list, starting with number 100 and working up.
And I'm Matt. I'm replacing the top 100 entries on Spin Magazine's 2015 list of the top 300 albums from 1985 until 2015, starting with number one and working down.
Once we finish these lists off, we'll do some fun activities with the new replacement lists we've collaborated on. But before we can get there, we have to do this. Today's title to be replaced is The Best Years of Our Lives, the Best Picture winner from 1946, directed by William Wyler. Shot by Greg Toland, edited by Daniel Mendel, and with a true all-star cast of people who I really adore, Frederick March, Dana Andrews, and Myrna Loy, and Teresa Wright, and of course Harold Russell, who won not one but two Oscars for his performance in this particular movie. This is one of my favorite movies, and it's definitely turned into a favorite that I just keep returning to over and over again, which is a lot for me because I hate watching movies more than once most of the time. But this one, I feel like a pull to go back to pretty often. This one is one that the AFI list has also returned to in a weird way. This is the only movie that was in exactly the same place in 1998 and 2007, which is one of my favorite trivia factoids about it. Just a truly weird set of circumstances. Like, I guess there's no reason they have to move movies up and down a list, but it's just very funny that they're like, this one is exactly 37. We got this one right the first time.
I think that needs to be a bit whenever they keep doing it. This will always stay 37.
Yeah, when I tried to predict what the next list would look like, I just kept this at 37 because I'm like, they like it there. It appears to be what they want.
That, if we know anything, it's that this is the 37th movie.
So this is a film which I feel like in the present time is, I don't know, it's too famous and too well-loved not to really be like underseen. But I think the 1946 movie that everyone returns to now is It's a Wonderful Life, and for good reason. Not that, like, in 1946, The Best Years of Our Lives was hailed as, like, probably the most popular, maybe the best-reviewed movie since Gone with the Wind, and I don't think that's, like, wrong. It's just that It's a Wonderful Life was also there in 1946, and that's turned into the movie of the year for so many of us. But this is not a bad second choice for it. It's the story of three veterans who all live in Boone City, who are returning from World War II and trying to get a flight out there because obviously the war is over and it's time for them to, you know, return to their lives, however that looked in the first place. Boone City is basically just Cincinnati, which is, I mean, it's not super important, but it gives you a sense of what the movie is after. You know, something pleasingly Midwestern flavored, something a little bit down home, where you can sort of mix up your regions, but definitely, it's definitely not the West Coast, and it's definitely not the East Coast. They wanted to stick it somewhere in the middle. So the three people who come back, Frederick March is playing a guy named Al, who is discharged as a sergeant in the army. He's much older than the two other men who he's wound up with. He's the only one who is married and has a family. He's returning to two children who are both pretty old, like high school, college aged. He's been married to his wife for a long time, and he also was a banker in civilian life. So he ended up in this, like, you know, he wasn't like a real officer. He was a middle-aged sergeant running around. So he's definitely something of an outlier. the highest ranking guy is a captain who was in the Air Force flying bombers. That's Fred. Fred is played by Dana Andrews. And before the war, he was like literally a soda jerk, which is a profession they even make fun of in West Side Story, just to give you a sense of how far down on the totem pole he was. So he's a person who really made it good in the Army, has some dreams of, you know, a better job, a better position, now that he's actually proven himself in a really serious way. But he also comes from some disadvantages. He doesn't have any professional connections. This is the only job he's ever really learned how to do, besides, you know, making ice cream sundaes at a drugstore counter. He is married to a woman he barely knows. It's one of those like rapid military marriages, and they know very, very little about each other. He just knows that he's supposed to be coming home to this wife, and he's hoping that she's excited. You know, we can sort of guess where this is going. And then the final one is a naval veteran named Homer. And Homer, played by Harold Russell, is interesting because he's one of the most forward actors with a disability who you can find in a Hollywood movie. I think the only other person who's like really staring me in the face here is Lionel Barrymore, who his ability to walk was really limited once he got older. But Harold Russell, they found him because this really happened to him. He was in combat and he got his hands blown off. So this is someone who has prosthetic hands, prosthetic like hooks, basically. And one of the first things the movie does is to show that he can use those things really effectively. Like, you watch him like pulling a match out of a pack with his hook and then like lighting it and then lighting a cigarette. You watch him signing his name. So like the movie is very, very forward about, this is someone who definitely retains his fine motor skills, who obviously has a disability, but like clearly can do something with his life, that his life is not over because he's been pretty grievously wounded. So that's the setup. I mean, it's a 3-hour movie. There's a lot of drama that goes into it. There's romantic drama, there's family drama, there's economic drama. Nobody fits all that well into the old role. Al has turned into an alcoholic overseas. This is something which the movie doesn't make it seem like he had a big problem at home beforehand, but the war has definitely like changed him as a person. You know, there's some lines about how his pants are too big for him now. He's like kind of swimming in these pants, that he lost a lot of weight, and he's, you know, not the comfortable patrician lordly banker type anymore. He's now more of this hard scrabble man of the people, down to the fondness for cheap alcohol thing. Fred, we've talked about, someone who keeps looking for a job and finds that not only does being a bombardier and a successful pilot, not only does that not qualify you for a lot of civilian jobs, but he's even been eclipsed in the civilian world by people he used to boss around. So like now he's just like lost time being a soda jerk. And Homer is really struggling to feel normal again, like a former football player, a former basketball player, and now someone who the neighbor kids like look in on and look at him like he's a freak. He doesn't quite know what to do with the literal girl next door he was going to marry, and like all of this is swirling around these people. They're all struggling, man. It's hard to come back from the war, which, I mean, seems incredibly obvious, but I think people don't give Hollywood, this is going to be the stupidest sentence, people don't give Hollywood enough credit for talking about how difficult it is to like actually manage returning from wartime. There are a number of movies in the general vein of the best years of our lives. A lot of movies about returning vets and people who are finding it genuinely difficult to do so, that it's not as simple as we just pick up our lives and we start the baby boomer generation and we all move into a house and everyone's really cheerful and we're all taking advantage of our GI Bill and stuff. Like there's a genuine investment in showing these films in the 1940s, like the late 1940s and into the 50s. But like the high point of the genre is definitely 46, 47, where people are trying to adjust to what it means to not be a soldier anymore in the biggest war in human history, especially for people like Fred and like Homer, who got plucked from their teenage years or their early 20s and really don't have any adult experience to speak of, and now are being told, let's get you at being an adult, right? Let's get that adulthood thing going for you. Let's make sure that you are in a marriage with someone who you really don't know anything about. Let's make sure that you have a job, even if that job is well below the responsibility and interest that you're used to. There are so many things that are good about this movie, which is why I'm kind of focusing on plot more, because I could go down a rabbit hole with virtually anything about this. The craft on this movie is just absolutely spectacular. But I'll pause here. What do we make of this movie so far? I don't know. Like, this is such a big movie, and yet you can tell me if you've seen this, have familiarity.
No, I haven't seen it, though. Hearing you basically gush about it has thrown me off.
I know, isn't it weird?
Yeah. No, what you're saying about, I don't know, I was kind of shocked. Like, I feel like I knew that Hollywood was not even just World War II, but like interested in the returning home kind of narratives. Like, I think that is well represented. And like, I knew that. And so hearing about this one, I was like, that's a totally, right? It's not a shocking revelation, like, but that's a totally fine formula to work with. I think if what comes out is something humane, like actual care about what does happen to these folks. And so I'm drawn in that way, because it sounds like, I don't know, not a domestic drama. That's not what I mean, but like a pretty simple conceit, but it's just like, how do these folks live in the world? And that I find pretty appealing. Like, that doesn't have to be some deep biting thing. Just like, let's actually invest in some character. But the setup itself, it's like, yeah, coming back from war, no one knows what to do. And coming from one so big, like, no one at home knows what to do either. It's like, how does
which this happen? Which is, I think, one of the most interesting things that it does. It's like, all three of the guys share a taxi going back into town, and there's a lot of excitement as they fly over Boone City, and there's a lot of excitement as they point out the stuff, and there's, like, the complaining about how their baseball team is still bad after all this time. Like, there's a lot of that going on. But all of them are extremely hesitant to be the first guy out of the cab. And all of them really struggle with knowing what to do when they actually come home. They kick Homer out of the cab first, and he gets surrounded by everyone who just like hugs him. And they're like, aw, that's so nice. It's going to be great for him. And then they drop off Al next because that's how we find out that Al is a very well-off man. Fred is like, you live here? Like, I didn't realize you were royalty. And then Al has this like sort of silent moment with his wife. March and Myrna Loy are very well paired in this movie. And then Fred goes home, and we find out the reason that he wants to be the last guy in the taxi is because he comes from basically a shanty town. And he's got a mom and dad who are living in squalor, like not like, you know, it's like that industrial squalor of, we don't have any money and we're never going to have any money. And that's just kind of the way it is. And it's interesting because their families are some mix of awed by them. Like, Fred has been such a success in the war that his dad, like, kind of, like, hero worships him. And then on the other hand, Al gets his wife and his daughter, played by Teresa Wright, who is perfect in this. And they go out on the town and they're just deeply confused about why it is that this guy who was, again, the sort of like a parody of respectability before he left, why is he like this now? And they're obviously uncomfortable with him, which I think is really, really special to show. It's like, there's a very nice moment of reunification for everybody. Everybody has a moment of that like tenderness at first, and then all of them find their families like trying to reach out to them, but it's not the way that they need to be reached out to, or they're hesitant to take what their families are giving them. It's very honest, I find. It's a very real portrayal. And of course, part of what's so fascinating about this movie is that William Wyler, who was directing it, someone who was much more like Frederick March's age, he directed multiple documentaries for the armed services during World War II, and that required him to like be in combat missions. The best of them and the most famous of them is Memphis Belle, where he is in a bomber he and his crew are in a bomber, and they're like doing a mission, like a bombing mission over Europe and like bombing Germany. And they are getting this footage of fighters swarming in to try to shoot down their planes and footage of bombers being shot out of the sky and sort of like falling towards the earth. And it's this incredibly gripping, incredibly dramatic, and incredibly sobering documentary. And the number of flight missions that Wyler went on like wrecked his hearing. Like, he was mostly deaf while he was making this movie. So this is another person who like was in a lot of ways facing up to similar challenges that the characters in the film were facing up to. Somebody who had gone to war as one kind of guy and then came back with this disability. Some of his hearing came back, not all of it certainly, but some of his hearing did return, but not for most of this production, which is a very interesting and I think again adds to the humanity of the movie.
I was about to say, I was just hearing on like Ben-Hur
better, but like it was still not the same game. Like, I think it really damaged him for good. Steven Spielberg's dad flew B-25s in World War II, and he talks about like it was the loudest thing in the entire world because it was just metal being buffeted around in the sky, and like that screwed up his dad some. Yeah. And he's like, that must have really done a number on Wyler too, because it was really just bare metal and then the wind, and it was just super loud.
I don't like it, but I like it filmatically. That the hero welcome happens first, because that's just so pat, and it's like, yeah, cool, but that doesn't help integrate these people into a society they're fundamentally unfamiliar with now, and like just does not help them cope with returning and having some sense of like calm, which I think itself is just severely off-putting. I don't know. I like that the focus on that seems to stand out more, because the like hero worship thing, I think, is interesting in the context of the family. For what Al? No.
No, it's Al.
Fred. Yeah. Oh, it is Al.
I mean, they all have families, but.
Well, no, but I meant the dad, like, yeah. Hero worshiping. Yeah. I think that's interesting, but the kind of like celebratory moment, it's like, yeah, it's good to get out of the way and really just focus on. It doesn't matter if they're being celebrated. They don't know what to do. And the people close to them don't know what to do either.
And something else that I really think is very subtle about this movie is that all three of them have successes as they come home. Like, there are things that happen with them that are successful and that they're good at and that work for them. And there are other things which are completely unsuccessful for them. Like, it's not like, it's not like some monolithic, like, oh, it's all so bad for everybody. Like, when Fred comes back, his marriage immediately craters, and his job prospects are bad, but he instantly forms this friendship with Peggy, who is Al's daughter, and who is this, like, again, the most perfect woman in the world. And that's a successful thing. When Homer comes back, he's really, really out of sorts with his girlfriend, Wilma, played by another personal favorite of mine, Kathy O'Donnell. But where he's not a failure is he is incredibly good with his uncle, who runs a bar and is played by Hoagie Carmichael, of all people. And, like, that's not a failure. It's like he doesn't fall out of touch with him. And then for Al, he finds himself sort of swimming at work, treading water as he's trying to, like, give loans to ex-military guys based on their character, even though they don't have any collateral to speak of. And he's finding himself very much at odds with his boss and finding himself at odds with, like, the banking world. But he is more successful because his wife is so good at, like, keeping him on the straight and narrow, essentially, like, doing the right things to help him out. So it's interesting that all of them have these, like, these yes, this is good, and all of them have, like, no, this is not working, and I'm really struggling here. But it's not, I mean, it's overwhelming, but it's not the only thing that defines their homecoming or their status as people.
Now, how many Hoagie Carmichael joints do we have on the list?
That's actually a good question. I think it might actually be more than one. But
love when he shows up.
Yeah, like, and I mean, he's good in this. No, I think this is the only one. This is the only one that he's that he's in on the AFI list. I have thought about throwing to have and have not on here before, so we may not have seen the last of Hoagie Carmichael.
But no, I like that too. That sort of muted. Yeah, I'm going to stick with muted. Kind of take. I mean, it is sobering, I guess, that it's like, it's not just the hero's welcome. They have internal struggles. It's not all struggle. Like, they're clearly skilled individuals who, like, have things they can do, but it's a matter of, I don't know, they're out of time. Not like, I mean, not out of time in the sense that they're imminently dying, but just like they're men out of time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I'm going to go with muted, that it's like, there's not an axe to grind, really. It's just, what is it like to reintegrate? So yeah, it sounds appealing. I can see why you're gushing over it. Ideas-wise, I'm sure there's a lot of great craft happening in here that actually speaks to you more. But
I mean, the Greg Tolan cinematography on this is, this is the guy who shot Citizen Kane, and I think there's a very good argument to be made that this is his best work. Like, he shoots the hell out of this thing. There are nobody needs me to tell them, like, what are the good shot scenes in this, because there are so many. But just, like, watching this thing, it's an absolute feast. Like, it's one of the reasons, I mean, the acting is better, the writing is better, whatever, but, like, one of the reasons why this movie is really special and why people can't make it in 2023 is because there's not a Greg Toland running around either.
So on your own list, well, okay, actually two questions, if you'll humor me.
Yeah.
All right, Tolan, Roger Deakins, how do they compare for people listening at home?
I think for people now, Deakins is kind of the standard bearer as the person who makes light happen the best. Like, this is someone who has, like, a profound ability to shoot something in the most beautifully lit way. And he's shown that ability across genres. So, like, you see it in Blade Runner 2049, where, like, the reason that movie looks so good is not because he uses neon, because any idiot can and does use neon to make stuff happen. But like, he manages to fog that up in such a way that's like truly, truly special to watch. And he'll also do it in like a Western. The one that you see people talk about most is Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford, where he gets light out of a train robbery at night or during magic hour. That's just like, it's not on the magic hour stuff is not unprecedented, but the train scene might be. Like, it really is that special. I prefer Tolan for composition. Tolan for his use of focus. I feel like Tolan is also such a, like, a biblical figure for so many cinematographers now that you, like, Deakins, I think, is harder to imitate, is harder to, like, borrow from, just because there's such, like, a personal vision in that. But Tolan is also, he's so foundational, like, in the way that Citizen Kane is foundational for directors, like, Tolan as a cinematographer is almost always listed as, like, if not the greatest, then, like, the most influential DP. Which is especially sad because he died so young that, like, there's like a fairly limited set of films that he actually got to shoot.
My other question is, in your personal version, is this 37?
I was actually going to go check on that.
No, good. We're on the same page.
It's 29.
Oh,
I know. And I've seen more movies than the AFI is willing to admit will exist. But yeah, I've got this for me, like, just to put this in context for people, the movies around it, My Darling Clementine, The Exorcist, Taboo, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Sunrise, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Blade Runner, Days of Heaven, Meek's Cut Off. Like, that's the group that it belongs in for me. It's just so special, and it's so unlike all of those other ones too.
Go Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Also, watching the, like, slow ascent of The Exorcist for you is one of the most fascinating things, but that was a past episode.
If someone had told me how religious it was earlier, I would have gotten to it.
Okay, so slightly above the AFI, but I think it needs to stay there forever now.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely, I think 37 is honestly, like, a really good place for it. And I understand how square that must make me sound, but it just, there are just so many things that it does well, and it's so hard to even nitpick to find what it's not doing well. It's just a very, very special movie. All right. I talked about that for a long time. I feel like we should do the theme.
I don't know. This does. Maybe this is just. I don't know the word. I was going to say fan fiction, but that's not right.
I feel like I'm fanboying to some
extent.
Yeah,
there we go. There we go. Just a fanboy episode.
Trying to decide how long it. When's my next fanboy episode? It's actually kind of going to be a while before I get another one that I, like, get right, stupid then. About.
All right, then get your rocks off.
Yeah, well, I feel like that was half an hour of excitement about a movie is about as much as I can stand. So the theme for the best years of our lives is the best years of our lives? ? So Matt will get to choose which movie best suits that theme based on the arguments presented. All chosen movies head to their subtitles replacement list, and remember, the goal is not to choose the work that's the best or most important, but to choose the one that best suits the theme. So, I'm actually glad we spent a lot of time talking about the story in this, because it's a funny title for what is obviously a very dramatic and very difficult time for the people in the film. Like, either they're returning from the war or their lives are now dominated by people who are returning from the war. Like, you can't just be like, and now my life goes on as usual, because that's not how it works. And to call this the best years of people's lives when they are suffering from PTSD, when they literally don't have hands anymore, when they are succumbing to alcoholism, when they are, you know, maybe a little bit powerless to help people as they are struggling so much. Like, to me, that's so fascinating. And of course, this does have a happy ending because, you know, Hollywood slash, could you imagine if they made a movie in 1946 that just like, and these people are screwed up forever?
I mean, it's what I want, but no, they never would have done it.
Great job, FDR. these people are ruined. I'm thinking about that movie.
I'm curious though, you blamed FDR the most.
Like that's what it would be. It's just very funny to like imagine people blaming Roosevelt for it.
Yeah, what gets closest
to a movie that says they're ruined forever?
In that historical moment.
Oh boy.
I mean, roughly considered.
No, that's literally 1947. It's a great question.
Because, like, we know they're Vietnam and, like, I suppose even some Iraq war stuff now where it's like, yeah, these people are just fucked. But, yeah, I'm thinking, like, this post-World War II moment in particular.
Yeah, because, I mean, even if you look at the Vietnam stuff, like, most of those don't even suggest that the people are, like, truly screwed, you know? Coming home has like a hopefulness to it.
I'm more meant, I think, for later ones, there are like big, obvious examples that suggest that. Not that it's the average, but like Apocalypse Now does enough work.
Right. Yes. Some of those people, don't go home again. Yeah. I think the one that I'd probably point to as being the most pessimistic, just like offhand, is probably Homecoming. It's a Clark Gable and Baxter movie.
I will say these have great names for what they're digging into.
They do have solid names. Clark Gable is a doctor who got pulled into the war and left behind his perfect life with his perfect wife Ann Baxter, and fell in love with a nurse played by Lana Turner who dies. And like, it sort of comes out slowly but surely that like the war has blown up the marriage that he's coming back to, that he's personally been damaged enough by it, that it's not ever going to be the same. And like the two of them, Ulysses and his, I forget what Ann Baxter's name in this movie is. I mean, it's obviously like very Odyssey adjacent. Like it's not shy about that. But like, her name is Penny, right? Of course it is. Yes, Ulysses and Penny. They have this moment where like, I can't help you with this. I couldn't help you, but I'll try to help you with it. And, like, it's not that it's not convincingly acted or anything, but, like, it's not a convincing conclusion. Like, it's always, that thing from the war is always going to be between them, and it's not a question of, like, I can't help you with your war troubles, but, like, there is something else from this that is always going to be under your fingernails as we do this, and I think that's one of the more pessimistic ones.
Thanks, FDR.
Thanks, FDR. So the reason why I think everybody has these like best years of our lives ? Is because it's a time for hopefulness. That the best years of our lives are the ones where we can have hope. And the years or the like weeks, basically, because that's what we're seeing in the movie. A time when we can have our cats come to visit us. Do you want to say anything, Bud?
Is it the best years of your life?
He says the best years of my life will be when I get the bowl back and I don't have to wait for people to feed me. That's what he's looking forward to. But like in the film, it's because it's a time of possibility and hopefulness that even even though there are bad things happening, there is opportunity to be seized. So, like, for example, Al gives a big old middle finger to banging as an industry at a dinner where, like, he's still using some Dutch courage for it. And that's something that the movie doesn't act as if that's going to go away anytime soon. But he is convincing about maybe we need to look at the way we do money differently and really consider someone's character and think that character makes them a good bet rather than just having some money that we can loan them and expect that the money will come back, that it's a better investment to do that, which, what a lovely idea and so much not what finance is about.
Isn't it pretty to think so?
Fred has this hope that's built because he falls in love with Al's daughter and she falls in love with him. And there's this incredible scene where she like tells her parents that she's going to break up a marriage, which is just like for 1946, like just sucks the air out of the room. It's really terrific. But there's hope for Fred because somebody takes a chance on him, gives him a job, which is not going to like pay him a lot of money, but at least has some opportunity to advance if he's like working hard and stuff. And he has hope because there might actually be the right person to start a family with. And there's an opportunity to do that, even if he screwed up the first one. And then Homer, we find that he has hope because Wilma is not scared of his disability, which is, again, just like such an interesting thing that Homer is not, in front of other people, scared of his disability. But when he's alone, he's scared of it. And like, he's trying to balance this feeling of like, I know that I can do things, but I will never do things the way that I thought I could. And that's something that the movie handles really delicately. And there's a really gorgeous scene where Wilma helps him to like take the prosthetics off and like put him in bed. And he's like, if you marry me, which I'm trying to like get you to not do, you will have to do this like every night. And that's what you're signing up for. And I don't want to put you through that. And then the hope is that she's like, well, it's, you know, I'm not marrying you for your hands, dude. Like, there are things about your character that I care more about. And that's where the hopefulness comes in. It ends with the wedding. It ends with the promise of another wedding. And I think that's where the title comes from. This idea that there is hope. Maybe even more hope than there was when people were flying their missions or sailing to their next engagement or whatever the case might have been.
This is exceedingly rude, but does the movie do any joking about take my hand in marriage?
No, they do put the ring on his hook.
Oh.
Yeah.
That makes me happy.
Yeah.
So this one's a serious question for as I assess going forward. So you don't see suggestion in the movie that the title is like not ironic, but cheeky in some way where it's like the best years of our lives are gone?
No, I mean, I don't think the movie has a lot of like sardonic energy in it is the thing. Like it's kind of too earnest for it. But I think, I mean, if when it does call it that, I think that there is some suggestion that like, how can these be the best years of our lives, especially if we're so, you know, in so much trouble now? How can we assume that the best years of our lives are ahead of us or right the second? Where clearly, if you're Homer and you're a multiple sports star, that had to be right. Or if you're Al yeah. and you were comfortable and happy and rich, how could that not have been? I mean, for Fred, it's so interesting because it seems like the best years of his life were the ones where he was flying bombing missions over Germany. Like that was the best of it. And now like coming home, it's like, it's a real it's a real downgrade, which again sounds insane, but he was respected in one case, and that's the most respect he's ever had in his life. So yeah, I don't know that it's sardonic, but it is certainly questioning. I think it's definitely trying to hypothesize what that might mean.
All right.
So we have two options. The first one is from 1993, and that is Groundhog Day, directed by Harold Ramis. And our second option is the 1944 Technicolor classic Meet Me in St. Louis, which I'm not going to say Meet Me in St. Louis because it sounds so dumb. But of course, that's a Vincent Minnelli, Judy Garland joint. And we will start with Groundhog Day, because that one, The Best Years of Our Lives, is really important. I think, what is it? The guy who figured out how long Bill Murray has to spend in Punxsutawney is like 37 years or something. Like, so really, that's like a true Best Years of Our Lives scenario.
Movie of my people.
Yeah. I was going to ask, what do you think it's like to spend 37 years of your life in
Punxsutawney? There are worse places. I know a lot of people in like similar situations, and it's not because of a random time loop. So I think there are worse ways, but, I wonder how many different, groundhogs one would encounter in 37 years in Punxsutawney, though. Or whistle pigs, as we call them.
I feel like that's something you could definitely get a doctorate figuring out if you're in the right program. There are so many good quotes about how long he's stuck there. I'm definitely going to, I think my favorite is, "You want a prediction about the weather? You're asking the wrong Phil. I'll give you a winter prediction. It's going to be cold. It's going to be gray. It's going to last you for the rest of your life." And I feel like that's the basic premise, which I feel like I don't have to explain, but it's the premise of how someone really got good at one episode of Jeopardy and learned how to impress the old people in a bed and breakfast about it. I mean, the concept is there, we can take a step back here, but like this concept has taken on a real life of its own. Like there aren't that other, there's not like so many other movies where I feel like you can just say the title and people want to use that concept of like being stuck in that repetitive moment. Like I think Sliding Doors has kind of taken on some popularity, but Groundhog Day is like really a special.
It's the equivalent of Stan, the Eminem song.
Yeah.
Like Groundhog Day is the same level. That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that, but like it is a verb or a like sensation as much as it is just a reference point to a movie. Yeah, that's a good point. I'm hard pressed to think of any movie that captures the same
thing. It's like, or to the same level. I mean, The Matrix does that, I think.
I think like stuff in The Matrix like really is what stands out more, but like, yeah, The Matrix itself to some Inception.
Yeah, like I think The Matrix is too polysemous. Like, there's too much going on there.
I think Inception probably does, but that's also like used more. I can't believe I'm saying this. Like, ironically, than Groundhog. Like Groundhog Day. Yeah, like Groundhog Day. It's like I think people actually feel that Inception's more of a like, here's a weird thing, and it's Inception.
Like they couldn't just call it Pennsylvania Ennui. You know, like
we got a lot of it.
As much as that might have been a better title, like it's less marketable.
I mean, I think it's clever too. And that Groundhog Day itself, I mean, it's kitschy, and trust me, we Central Pennsylvanians take it very seriously. But it is also like a literal break in time. Like time stands still for a minute, not really, but for the pomp and circumstance of it. So like, I think there is something to like naming it that just like captures that essence anyway. But yeah, to me, the equivalent is Stan. Like, those are the two things mm-hmm. where they become terms outside of the scope of the text.
So my idea for this one, and once again, nobody needs this explained to them, but like, what if the best years of your lives were the years that made you better, and all 37 or 39 or however many years it is that that Phil Connors is stuck in Punxsutawney through this strange time loop that he's managed to get into. And of course, like, that's like the general plot of the movie. And one of the things which I think is really compelling about this movie is that there's no particular reason that he should figure out. I mean, he doesn't figure it out technically, but like, there's no particular reason that being a better person should be the thing that knocks you out of this time loop. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it seems like in a truly, I don't know, realistic is not really the word I'm looking for here, but like in the uncaring universe that I think most of us believe that we live in, this should not be the answer. Like, the answer should just be to kidnap Punxsutawney Phil and take him flying off a cliff or driving on the railroad tracks and getting stopped and ordering a bunch of flapjacks from a cop. Like, there are certain... That guy's my hero, by the way. And flapjacks.
And flapjacks. I found the number. Or a number, anyway. Estimate that he likely spent over 12,000 days in the time loop, or roughly 33 years.
Oh, man. 12,000 days. Like, and I love that it's, like, based on, like, how long would it take you to get good at piano? How long would it take you to get good at ice sculpting? Like,
how long was Jesus alive?
Just an absolutely incredible, incredible amount of math going into that. That's up there with my Jimmy Chitwood is the greatest athlete in the history of humanity thing. Like, research that people have done on the internet. Like, that's up there with it.
And flapjacks.
So, like, that's one of the things that I like about this. That Phil goes from, like, I'm just going to eat like a maniac because it doesn't matter, or I'm going to find all of the comely women of Punxsutawney and just figure out how to trick them into sex. And sort of, or just like, goes from what creative method of suicide am I going to find today? He eventually gets to this point of, I'm just going to try to do better things. And it starts with that old guy that he just, like, can't stop from dying no matter what he does. And there's that line before that happens where he says, I think I'm God. And it's like, if not the God, at least a God, because, like, he can't die and, like, he's in this strange situation. But, like, that's the thing that shocks him out of it. Like, that's the thing that makes him realize that he doesn't actually control life and death. He's not actually in control of this very limited situation, but like, there are things that are more powerful than him. And then I don't know, eventually he gets to a point where he gets Punxsutawney syndromed into the newscast where he talks about can't imagine a better fate than a long and lustrous winter on television. I don't know. There's something really interesting about how we grow from feeling his panic of being stuck in this place, this one horse, one groundhog town, and then finding it to be this really warm, friendly, interesting place full of people who, like, you might actually want to know a little bit. Once you get this sort of past this, look at all of these annoying rubes business. Like, once he actually starts opening up, like, those people actually start to seem like, you know, nice enough people, like the waitresses at the diner, the people who are running the show with the groundhog who he has tortured on so many occasions and then finally gives the Heimlich to one of them to save his life. Like, it starts to feel like a place that you can belong in, as opposed to a place that you're going to be stuck in. And having never been to Punxsutawney, I don't know that I can give my own personal version of this. But yeah, that's sort of where I am about this movie, which again is funnier, like a lot funnier, when it's about Phil Connors meeting Ned Ryerson over and over again, and trading stepping in large icy puddles with punches. The setup of Ned? And then bang, will always be one of the things that makes me laugh the most. But like, the reason why I think this film is so good, the reason why it's not just a romantic comedy to me, or not just a 90s classic, is because there is this beating heart that does say, like, that it turned into the best years of his life. Like, it's hard to look at Phil Connors, the weatherman from Pittsburgh, the guy who's in the snow yelling, "I am the weather." There's no way to like look at that guy and say the best years of his life were when he was a meteorologist at a Pittsburgh news station. Like, clearly the best years of his life are the ones where he improved himself and did things for other people and actually like gave a crap about being a person who has ideas, who tries out poetry for the first time, or, you know, can interact with children, either by rescuing them from trees or by like having snowball fights with them. Like, that's clearly a better person. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really telling that I don't think I've said Andy McDowell's name once in this entire, who I think is a really kind of an underrated actress, but just is not important to this movie.
Do you ever have any deja vu? I don't think so, but I can check with the kitchen.
I originally had this on my subtitles list because of the screenplay. There's a future episode that I'm using a screenplay list as a basis for it, and I'm like, this screenplay is one of those incredibly masterful documents. Because, I mean, when people think about screenplays, I think a lot of the time we think about like, oh, how quippy is it, or how funny is it, or how memorable is this individual line? When so much of the job of a good screenplay is like structuring and moving the movie, and this one just succeeds so beautifully on both of those fronts. Like, this thing has an exquisite structure and it's put together so well, but it is also endlessly quotable. And like, I feel like I've scratched the surface of the stupid things that happen in here. Like, I feel like we could do Remember That Guy for longer than the length of this movie with all of the dumb, entertaining, fun things that happen.
He might be okay. Well, no, not now.
Not now.
Yeah, I'm glad to see this movie anywhere. I love this thing.
Yeah, it's a movie where, again, I think it does have this in common with The Best Years of Our Lives, we said for the first time about these two movies together, that there is something about, like, the best years of your life are maybe not going to be obviously apparent to you. That if you were to, like, summarize them for yourself, you might look at them and say, I don't know, man. I don't think being estranged from my wife, who I already barely know, and waking up with night terrors about my dead war buddy, I don't know that I'm going to call that the best years of my life, but they are. And if you look at Phil and you say, hey man, the best years of your life are going to be the 33 years that you spend reliving this one day in this one town, You know, like, you couldn't make me believe that, and I've seen this movie before. And yet, because they're the years that make him into a better person, someone who's actually, like, worth knowing or worth talking to or worth, I don't know, acknowledging, like, even at the most basic level, that's what makes these the best years of his life. And it's funny because I don't think that whatever happens between Phil and Rita will be the best years of his life. Like, I really think this is going to turn out to be the big one for him. Like, the big chunk of his life that is most meaningful, most important, and best overall.
There's something to, like, what leads up to the realization is the best, and, like, anything after may be good. Like, Phil and Rita might have a happy life, but it's not the best because it didn't set up that.
Yeah, like, there's more value in this. There's more value in... Oh, my God. Did you know that iron sharpens iron? Did you know that pain is just weakness leaving the body? Did you know that you could send an entire tweet that's just emojis? Like, I feel like a high school athlete right now, but there is something about, like, what makes you into the person in retrospect turns out to be more meaningful than the person you actually are.
It's about life, man.
All right. So the next movie is Meet Me in St. Louis, which
is sadly lacking in Groundhogs.
Well, what it lacks in Groundhogs, it makes up for in Margaret O'Brien, and I can't wait to talk about this. But this one, I'm cheating a little bit because it is technically more of a year in the life movie as opposed to years in the life. But the basic premise that I'm trying to pull from here. Maybe the best years of your life are the ones you already can't stand to lose. So throughout the story, it's set in, like, five seasons, basically. So spring happens twice, and then the summer, fall, and winter of 1903. And it's about this family living in, you guessed it, St. Louis. Everybody's very excited about the upcoming World's Fair. There's not really an analog for it now, is there? Like, I don't think that there's any, like, single event around the world that can possibly match up to, like, the wonder that people feel about or felt back in the past about having the World's Fair in your city and seeing all of these new things. Like, the movie ends with these people witnessing electricity on a scale that they've never seen it before. Like, it's a terrific ending. Because I think in 1944, when people were watching it, they could still, depending on where they were, they could still feel wonder watching, like, an entire horizon line filling up with electric lights. But of course, in 1904, it's impossible to imagine that happening, and then to see it in front of your eyes, there's nothing quite like it. So that's part of it. The beginning and end are both spring, so people looking forward to it, and then people finally getting to go. But in the fall of 1903, the patriarch of this family in St. Louis, he's a lawyer and he gets a job in New York, and he tells his family that they're all gonna have to, you know, ship off from their lives there. The two older daughters, Esther, played by Judy Garland, and Rose, played by Lucille Bremer, the two of them both have guys who they've been putting the work in for, and they're, like, upset about leaving. The younger children are originally kind of excited, and then they, like, start to wonder about how sad it'll be to leave the place that's, like, the only place they've ever imagined. And then even the matriarch of this group, played by Mary Astor, is really disappointed. Grandpa, played by Harry Davenport, is really disappointed. Like, there's this incredible sadness at, like, what it might mean to leave St. Louis, where everybody feels very, very at home and very happy, where they feel a real connection with the place and with the people who are there. And then this idea of, we can't stand to lose this moment in time. We can't stand to lose this particular segment of our lives. And when we move to New York, there will be this finality to what the best years of our lives were. And this seems like an incredibly serious way to talk about this movie. And if it seems incredibly serious, it's because this movie is just transcendently weird. It is. Have you seen this one? Okay, this is one of the weirdest movies in American history, because none of it makes any sense. Like, the basic premise is we have this nice all-American family. The oldest son is going off to Princeton. Geez, there are a lot of children in this family. I didn't even think of it till now. There are five of them. So the oldest son's going to Princeton. Again, two daughters who are close to college age, both beautiful, charming young women, and then two younger daughters who will surely grow up to be beautiful, charming young women themselves. Big house, live-in servant, live-in grandpa. Everything just seems, as one character says, ginger peachy at one point. Like, it's a movie where people say ginger peachy, you know, like it's that kind of world, and it's all very square.
Does that come from that movie?
I don't know. I don't know how old that saying is.
That's good. You said it and I was like, oh, I haven't heard that in a while. And then I was, is this the origin point? I don't know.
It's the origin point of something very important. Whether it's ginger peachy or not, I don't know, but it's that kind of world. It's a world where someone who is very frustrated will say, I'll thank you not to twice in a single argument. I don't know. It's hard to even imagine what kind of conservative white people even want to go back to this world. Like, it's just absolute ridiculousness in that front. And it's also ridiculous because the youngest daughter, whose name we never actually hear, she is referred to always as Tootie. She's like maybe 5-6 years old, and she's probably the most horrifying human being I've ever seen in a film. Truly the leather face of Meet Me in St. Louis. Tootie is very small and has been burying her dolls in a makeshift cemetery in the backyard. I wish people could see the face that Matt is making right now. Like, this is like, she, like, the first reaction she has to, like, we're going to move to New York is, oh, I need to go into the backyard and dig up my dolls from the cemetery. This is a child who takes out her great sadness and frustration about moving later on. They've made snowmen in the backyard, and she goes back there and takes a stick and begins decapitating all of them because she says if she can't have them, no one will have them, and they have to die. And there's like an extended sequence where she's just beating the bejesus out of these snow creatures. There's a Halloween sequence where Tootie takes it upon herself to throw flour at a nice old guy in his home and then returns to her group and says, I killed them. And everyone's like, wow, Tootie's the most horrible. And she starts chanting, I'm the most horrible. I'm the most horrible. It's really special. Like, that's in this movie. At the same time as all of this other ginger peachy stuff. Like, the most tragic thing that happens to Judy Garland in this movie is that her boyfriend can't get his tuxedo from the tailor in time because he was playing basketball, leading to a line that I feel like I've lived, where she yells at him, I don't hate you, I just hate basketball. But, like, that's the worst thing that happens to Judy Garland in this movie, because, of course, they don't actually move. How could they possibly leave St. Louis? We might come back to the song in a second. I feel like there's some trivia that we need to do with the title song. But, like, that's the terrible thing that will happen to her. And in the meantime, you have this very strange younger sister who is just completely uncanny and came right out of a horror movie. And then at the same time, like, the feelings are all very real in this movie. There's a genuinely interesting sequence where Leon Ames and Mary Astor, in this moment of like family melancholy, kind of reunite over a song that they remembered from their younger years, that they sing in harmony together. And that kind of thing is in here too. It's just, it's a lot of movie. It's less than 2 hours, but it is a lot of movie, and it's weird, and it's, I think uncanny is really the word I want to use for it. Like, it's an uncanny Christmas movie is what it comes down to. It's a very, very strange text because all of these things that don't match are just like squished on top of each other in really fascinating ways. There are, I think, you know what? Here's what I would like to transition to. Do you know the song, the actual like title song, like the lyrics to Meet Me in St. Louis?
Oh, I couldn't tell you the lyrics offhand.
Okay. You wanna look them up real quick? And I'm trying to see if you can give us a dramatic reading of the first verse into the chorus. Let's do the chorus, yeah.
All right, let me find it here. I assume it's the thing that starts with Meet Me in St. Louis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Meet Me in St. Do they say Louis?
They say Louis.
Yeah. Meet Me in St. Louis, Louis. Meet me at the fair. Don't tell me the lights are shining any place but there. We will dance the hoochie coochie. I will be your tootsie wootsie. If you will meet me in St. Louis, Louis, meet me at the fair.
We will dance the hoochie coochie. I will be your tootsie wootsie. Like, that's, and it's not just that, it's not just that they say it, but that it is invariably, we will dance the hoochie coochie and I will be your tootsie wootsie. And it's like, that's this movie is like for people who are like, oh, that's so cute. I love that. And like people who also want to watch a 5-year-old run out into the snow and murder snowmen, presumably over the same places where her dolls are buried.
I do want to watch that. I was going to ask you, what do you think of the best days of her life?
Of Tootie's life?
Yeah.
I don't know. Probably the one where she gets to wear someone else's face and like put people up on a hook.
Fair. Fair.
I don't know. It's a really sweet movie. Like, I don't mean to make it sound like it's not incredibly charming and wholesome, but it's really, this is the kind of thing where I think, again, people don't give older Hollywood movies enough credit for just being absolutely bizarre. Like, you'll take like, oh, this is a really wonderful Judy Garland movie from her period where she was just running movies on her own, and it's a Freed Unit movie, and the cinematography is like candy coated stuff. It's a beautiful movie. And at the same time, there's just this running gag where the youngest sister is a true sociopath, just waiting to be unleashed on like Haddonfield, you know, like that's what we're walking towards. That was my first transition, because I did want to bring the rhyming pair of hoochie coochie and tootsie wootsie into the podcast. Other things you want to talk about before we get to the big money scene?
I just wonder what the steps of the hoochie coochie are now, but we can get to the money scene.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know about that. Hoochie coochie steps. Part 2, the history and etymology of the hoochie coochie. We're doing this now.
And does this have any relation to rock and roll coochie coo?
Oh, coochie coo. Okay, so this is from somebody's Blogspot, but it's the first result you get if you do Hoochie Coochie steps. The exotic erotic form of dancing popularized at the Chicago World's Fair of 1893 would only later become known as the Coochie Coochie or the Hoochie Coochie. The dance was generally referred at the Paris World's Fair as the stomach dance or a danse du ventre, the muscle dance, stomach dance, or the midway dance. So it sounds like the Hoochie Coochie is like the tummy thing.
Yeah. Oh. Huh.
Yeah. So that's how you know someone's your Tootsie Wootsie is if you can do the
Hoochie Coochie.
The danse du ventre. And that's the. What a weird movie.
I don't think it has any relation to rock and roll Hoochie Coo, sadly.
That's too bad.
Based on my initial looking. So I don't know that Rick Derringer had that in mind when he was writing.
So let's talk about Frank Sinatra, because I think that's a good way to get
He's
into.
He's someone who dances the Hoochie Coochie.
I don't know what he danced. try to imagine. I mean, I'm still thinking about Frank Sinatra trying to keep up with Gene Kelly dancing in those movies where they were together, and just was not flattering to Frank. It's a guy who was trying but was not on the same level. The money song from this is "Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas," which I think is one of the great Frank Sinatra standards. And Frank Sinatra, who just made a career out of stealing from the Garland Minnelli set. Of course, New York, New York is a Liza Minnelli thing via Martin Scorsese movie. And "Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas" with different lyrics is one of the most popular Frank Sinatra Christmas renditions. But of course, it gets its start here. In the scene, this is what I mean when I say it's a weird movie. Judy Garland, like, crying while Margaret O'Brien is sobbing on camera to this, the most melancholy version of the song, and of course the best version of the song, where it's not about, like, in the future, but, like, next year, here's what we will be doing, and it won't be as good as this year. It's the version of the song that has "until then we'll have to muddle through somehow," which of course is conspicuously absent from later versions because that's much too sad and much too contemplative for what I think a lot of people want to do around Christmas, because Christmas is secretly one of the saddest times of the year when we think about who used to be there at Christmas or our other experiences at the time. And that's something which this movie, again, it's a like a profound statement about the sadness of a holiday season, of the sort of flip side of the comfort of tradition is the inevitability of loss that comes with it when the traditional things begin to die away. And in this really beautiful scene, it's then followed up with the great decapitation of 1903. So like it's a very strange back and forth, but it's the centerpiece of this idea that the best years of your life are the ones that you're looking at and saying, I'm going to be so upset and so horrified and so alone when they're over. I mean, even the simplicity of Tootie saying at one point, like, Santa's not going to know where to drop off the presents. We've always been here. And it's like the most not horrifying thing that she says in the course of the entire film, but it's very true and very sweet that, like, that's how a 4, 5, 6-year-old child will look at moving. It's like, how will Santa know? Like, we're supposed to be in this place. This is where we belong. And this is where the good things happen.
And this is where my dolls are buried.
This is where the earth is made richer with the with the decaying remains of my dolls. I have people buried there, you know. It takes on a it takes on a really different meaning from this film. But I think that's what this is so much about, especially for characters who are younger. Like, Judy Garland's supposed to be like 17, 18, 19 in this movie. And, you know, we make a lot about how, like, one's teenage years are sometimes the best and the worst years of someone's life. Because that's true in so many different ways. But she definitely looks at those years as being the ones that she can't regain in any other way. And like this feeling of begrudging the future, which is not a winning strategy, but she does, even as like an 18-year-old, is a very, very sad and memorable way to look at it. And I think that's part of the reason why the song is as powerful as it is. Because that, I think that melancholic aspect is something you can't scrub from it, even if you change the lyrics around or play it on your record player or on Spotify or whatever over the course of the years. Anything else to hear or know about the home of the Hoochie Coochie?
Maybe our Tootsie Wootsie was all the Hoochie Coochie we danced along the way.
It makes my stomach hurt just thinking about it.
It's about life, man.
All right, and with that, it's time to end this episode. Ooh, no, real thoughts, yes.
No, not real thoughts.
No, that's okay.
Sorry. We're on brand still. No, I was doing some research in the background, and apparently Muddy Waters has a blues standard called Hoochie Coochie Man, though it appears to be less of a dance and more a braggadocious account of sexual prowess as induced by some hoodoo magic. So, I mean, I know this movie is weird as shit, but I don't know if it has hoodoo.
Not quite. We're a little, I mean, almost, but not quite. Mostly that just made me think about my dinnling.
Which one often does when they dance the hoochie coochie.
Drawing attention to one's dinnling. All right, so the general theme for this week, which takes its name from the title of the film, number 37 now and forever on the AFI list, the best years of our lives. So thinking about this concept of what makes something the best years of our lives, especially when you don't expect them to be. And I think that's the unstated but incredibly forward meaning in the film that we're basing all of this off of today. And then in Groundhog Day, where the best years of our lives are years that you might never hope to live, but they are years that turn you into a better person, that they are the best years of your life are the years that make you into a more moral, more ethical, more lovable, more complete kind of human being. And in Meet Me in St. Louis, maybe the best years of our lives are the years in which we can't bear the thought of not having them anymore. And even if those years are years where people are singing a song about Hoochie Coochie Tootsie Wootsie for 7 months, if they're years where your younger sister is going out with all the other young hoodlums and burning things in the street, which I somehow didn't even mention is like the concerted effort of children to create a bonfire and to terrorize the neighbors. Like, those are the times when you can't stand the thought of losing them, and that might make them the best years of your life. So I leave it to you to decide between a very normal movie like Groundhog Day and a very odd movie like Meet Me in St. Louis.
A very normal movie with how many attempted groundhog murders. As one does.
But allowing him to drive is very important as well.
All right. Though I sit here looking back fondly on my teenage hooliganism. hooliganry? I don't actually know what that would be. I don't think there is actually a word for it.
So I kind of want to combine hooligan and shenanigan and make it like hooliganigan or something, but...
All right, that hooliganigans.
Yeah.
I like that. You heard it here first, kids. Merriam-Webster, here we come. I like that, but I'm going to pick Groundhog Day because I think it fits more with how... the best years of our lives is looking at it. And it's part of why I asked that clarification at the beginning. Was it like, should I be looking at these ones in which we find ourselves are actually the best, even if they definitely don't seem like it? And you can really only tell that from hindsight, or are they ones that we cannot get back? And I think both are really interesting ways to look at it. But I think Groundhog Day fits what... best years of our lives is doing a bit more closely, in that it's, I mean, you look at it and on the surface and even deeper, it's like, there's no way, but there's something about this process of growth and of change and of experiencing both good and bad. And like, right. Honestly, the like terror and trauma that it would be to wake up, not wake up, but like to finally get out of a loop 33 years later, like, how are you going to, like, it's not all peachy. It's not all ginger peachy after that.
That's like coming home from a war in its own way.
I know. But like, right. How do you deal with that? So it's not, so yeah, I guess the suggestion that there's something there and you could be in it right now and no, you'll never really realize it in the moment. I just think that tracks a little better with Groundhog Day. So I'm going to go with that for, I suppose, the symmetry of it. But I think both are right. Interesting accounts of the theme and doing something a little bit different.
Yeah. Mostly these are three beloved movies. I think, you can definitely find people. I mean, I understand that I'm like overstating the oddness in Meet Me in St. Louis, but you definitely find people who treat it as a Christmas movie that they love in the same way that people love It's a Wonderful Life. And Groundhog Day, I think, was obviously like popular when it came out, but has also gotten kind of a second life, I think. Like, I think people have started talking about it as, again, the way that I think about it, which is not just like a good 90s movie, like, yay, but like as a really good movie, like a really, really good picture.
I don't actually know if this contributed to the revival, but I feel like it's a pretty good COVID movie.
Oh, yeah. I think, like, I mean, it was happening. Yeah, it was happening before COVID, but I think COVID definitely accelerated that process for a lot of people. And then The Best Years of Our Lives is just one of those standard bearers for good classic American movies, just like an absolute... like a TCM Hall of Fame kind of picture that people have, I hope, been treasuring for going on 80 years now. So that's my general feel. All of them are really wonderful movies. And we sort of talk about this, but like making a triple feature out of them, this would be a very interesting triple feature. Maybe even in this order would make for, I think, just a, like, it would feel good at the end. I think it would be a really nice, really fun. And this is not like me to say, but like a genuinely kind of heartwarming triple feature. It's good for the, I don't believe in souls. Good for the soul that people think they have. There we go.
I was trying to think of another like basic high school idiom, but I didn't have anything connected offhand, and iron sharpening iron didn't really fit again.
No. I hate the way this makes me talk about things. It just,
it'll make you feel things that you want to stitch on a throw pillow.
Just, where's my irony, man? I need some, bring me my irony.
In my episode.
Yeah, that's very true. If you enjoyed this episode, and if you enjoy listening to the two of us talk about cliches and whatever else, there is a part one of this episode in which a song, several songs, equally catchy to Meet Me in St. Louis and the Trolley song and so on, are brought up in the Big Beat episode. You can find that episode along with other back episodes at subtitlespodcast.com, which is where we keep some information about the two of us, some links to my Letterboxd, to his Spotify playlist, both blogs. And hopefully you go check that out. And until then, we will see you next time.